sled. Slank told the crew that if he found out who was in that hold or found anybody else going in there, he'd feed them to the sharks.
"It's a good plan," Peter said stubbornly. "It will work."
Alf studied Peter's face for a moment. "You really want to get into that trunk, don't you?" he said.
"Yes, sir, I do."
"Bad enough to risk your life?"
"Sir," said Peter, "I don't have much of a life now,
and for what I'm told, I'll have even less where I'm going. If there's something wonderful on this ship, I want to know what it is. This is my only chance, sir." Alf looked out to sea for several seconds, then back to Peter, and Peter saw there were tears in the big man's eyes.
"Little friend," Alf said, "those words are truer of me than they are of you."
He moved closer and put his head next to the boy's.
"Tell me our plan."
Chapter 15, The Attack. Captain Scott stood alongside the Wasp's helmsman, calling out commands that were relayed to the crew via the first mate's booming voice. Leonard Astor stood just behind Scott, his attention fixed on the ship pursuing them. The Sea Devil was gaining. No matter what maneuver Scott tried, the enormous black brazier grew steadily larger, blotting out much of the sky. For all the peril they faced, Leonard and Scott retained their British calm, sounding like two gentlemen discussing the weather.
"He will be upon us soon," Scott said.
"It appears so," Leonard answered.
"I would not have thought it possible," said Scott, shaking his head. "Those sails, I..."
He trailed off, then added,
"I assure you, sir, my men will be ready. We will repel them."
Astor was quiet for a moment, studying the Sea Devil, now close enough that he could easily see the scowling faces of the pursuing pirates, waving swords and shouting vile taunts at their quarry. He turned to Scott.
"Captain," he said, "I request to be put overboard in a dory with the trunk at once."
Scott stared at him, his composure momentarily deserting him.
"Are you daft, man?" he said. "You can't outrun that ship in a dory."
"No," Leonard agreed, "but it would force Blackstache to make a choice. If he chooses to go after me and the trunk, and I believe he will, then he'd turn broadside to the Wasp."
Leonard paused a moment.
"And if your starboard cannon were made ready and waiting..."
"He'd be squarely in the line of fire," said Scott.
He thought about it, clearly tempted for a moment, then shook his head.
"But so would you. And I'm sorry, sir, but I can't put you at risk like that. You'll stay on board."
The two men locked eyes for 5 long seconds, then Astor spoke again, his voice low and urgent.
"Captain, I remind you once again that I am on a mission for the Queen and that I speak with her authority. The trunk must not, cannot fall into the hands of this pirate. Your men are brave but clearly outnumbered. If the enemy boards us, we will be defeated. My plan involves risks, but it is our only hope. On the authority of Her Majesty, I order you have your men put me and the trunk over the side immediately."
Scott reddened and appeared to be on the verge of arguing. Then slowly he exhaled and turned to the first mate.
"Prepare a dory to starboard," he ordered. "Bring up Astor's black trunk. Have the men prepare the starboard cannons."
The first mate hesitated, surprised by the unexpected orders.
"At once," Scott said.
"Aye, Captain."
The first mate relayed the orders.
"Thank you, Captain," Leonard said.
"Do not thank me, sir. I fear those orders are your death sentence."
"Well," said Astor, "perhaps we can lessen the danger."
Scott answered with a questioning look.
"I believe you have an archer in your crew," said Astor.
"I do,"
said Scott. Leonard gestured up at the Sea Devil's huge, billowing, double-coned sail, now looming almost overhead.
"That garment appears to be made from a fine fabric," he said. "I suspect it would burn very well."
Scott squinted up at it, then looked at Astor with a small smile.
"So it would," he said. "You've seen battle, Mr. Astor."
"That I have."
Scott turned to his first mate.
"Send for Jeff, the archer," he said. "He'll want his bow and some flame."
Blackstache stood at the helm of the Sea Devil, watching his crew work as his ship closed on its prey. The ladies had performed as hoped. The Sea Devil felt almost as if it were flying across the water. The Wasp, sleek and fast as she was, didn't stand a chance. "Just wait till the ladies are raised on that mast," he thought.
"Not a ship in the world will outrun her."
This pleasant thought was interrupted by Smee's high-pitched voice.
Captain, they're launching a dory.
Stash snatched the spyglass and had a look. He drew a sharp breath. Not only were Wasp crewmen launching a dory, in it was a man in gentleman's clothing and a black trunk.
What trickery is this?
Stash frowned, pondering the situation. Was the trunk a decoy? If he turned to pursue it, the ladies would lose the wind and be useless. The Wasp would regain the advantage and quickly put water between them. But if he let the black chest escape and it proved to be the treasure...
Captain, should we...
Out of my way, shouted Stash, shoving Smee aside and striding quickly amidships, stopping at the cage holding the prisoner.
He knelt, reached through the iron bars, grabbed the man by the coat of his now filthy uniform, and pulled him close, so that only the rusting cage separated their faces. The prisoner recoiled from Stash's foul breath. Stash shoved the spyglass into the man's hand.
You tell me, mate, Stash said, that their trunk being loaded off the Wasp, is that the treasure?
The prisoner, weak with hunger and fear, trembled so badly that Stash had to support the spyglass for him.
Black and shiny she is, Stash said, helping him find it.
Wearing a gold emblem on her sides.
Yes,
the man stammered.
That's it, sir.
Stash leaned back, appraising the man's terrified face.
You understand, lad, if them words ain't the truth, they're your last on this earth.
I...
The prisoner tried to swallow, but could not.
I swear, sir, that's it.
Very well,
said Stash to himself. He stood, rubbing his chin absent-mindedly, wondering if...
Trouble, Captain!
It was Smee hollering from the upper deck, his stubby right arm pointing up. Stash looked up.
What now?
And then he saw it. The ladies were burning. Captain Scott patted Jeff the archer on the shoulder.
Good work,
he said, nodding toward the sea devil. The right cup of the enormous brazier was aflame, the flames spreading quickly.
Stand ready, son, he said. We'll need you again.
The archer, a thick, bald man, nodded. Scott looked across the ship to where Leonard Astor stood, waiting as sailors lashed the trunk inside the dory. Astor was staring at the trunk. Scott allowed himself a moment's speculation.
I wonder what's in there to be worth dying for.
Then called out to Astor.
Good luck, Mr. Astor. God willing, we will have you back on board within the hour.
Astor looked over, his green eyes intense. He said nothing, answering only with the briefest of nods. He touched the gold chain around his neck, feeling for the locket, as if assuring himself that it was there. Then he climbed into the dory and gestured to the bosun, who barked a command. Four sailors swung the dory out on its davits and lowered the little boat into the surging sea, carrying a passenger and a cargo that Scott was duty-bound to protect.
I had no choice, thought Scott. They gave me no choice.
Then he turned to the task of trying to save his ship. Black Stash knew when to cut his losses. Scott had a reputation as a clever sailor. The burning ladies were proof that it was justified.
Cut loose the ladies,
Stash ordered Smee.
Cut them loose, Captain,
said Smee.
The ladies!
Yes, you idiot! And now, before the masts and rigging catch fire, Stash said. Attach a mooring buoy to the starboard sheet, then cut them loose. We'll come back for them later.
Smee relayed the commands and the crew responded quickly. The flaming ladies floated away from the ship like a gigantic kite, then fluttered and sank, falling into the sea with a loud hiss and a cloud of steam. The mooring buoy bobbed nearby, marking the spot.
No wonder he's the captain, thought Smee.
Stash looked ahead. With his sails gone, his ship was now falling behind the Wasp.
Full sails!
He bellowed to the crew, bypassing Smee. The men scrambled to the lines, and the Sea Devil's regular sails were up in seconds. Stash was counting on them to steal the Wasp's wind, and he was gratified to see the fleeing ship's sails flutter. Now he knew he could catch the Wasp, but should he?
Or do I go after that dory?
The little boat with the gentleman aboard was just ahead of the Sea Devil now, perhaps 40 yards to starboard, close enough that Stash felt as if he could reach out and touch the trunk. He could see the gentleman watching him intently, betraying no emotion, his oars idle by his sides.
As if he wants me to come for him.
Stash knew he could easily chase the dory down by tacking to starboard,
but that he would lose his advantage over the Wasp, or, worse, expose his broadside to her cannon fire. He could pursue the Wasp, but it would take time to overtake her, and more time to defeat her. By then he might not be able to find the dory again.
What to do?
Stash cursed a particularly foul curse, and splattered the deck with an angry gob of spit.
Nobody understood how hard it was being captain.
With grudging respect, Scott saw how quickly Black Stash rid himself of the burning black sail, raised new sails, and continued the pursuit.
He's gaining again. He'll have us soon.
Scott pondered his options. He could turn broadside to try using his cannons, possibly taking Stash by surprise.
But he might already be close enough to board us before we can get off a shot.
He could jibe, ducking away from the Sea Devil sails, regain the wind advantage, and run for it.
But that would be leaving Asta behind.
He watched the dory, and Asta growing smaller, now a beam of the Sea Devil.
I can't leave him,
he studied the Sea Devil.
If he turns toward the dory, we will attack.
But what if the Sea Devil did not turn? Could he risk his ship and its entire crew to save the life of a single passenger? Scott felt the eyes of his men awaiting his next command.
Nobody understood how hard it was being captain.
Smee knelt next to the prisoner's cage and fumbled with a heavy ring of keys, nervous under Stash's glare.
Hurry it up!
Stash said, glancing up to check the Wasp and then the dory, now a beam of his ship and slipping behind. The prisoner, not knowing what was happening, watched apprehensively as Smee unlocked the padlock and opened the cage door. Stash pushed Smee away, grabbed the trembling prisoner by his uniform coat, and again pulled him close.
You've been most helpful,
said Stash, his voice oily.
Thank you, sir,
said the prisoner, daring to hope that his cooperation had won him freedom from the cramped cage.
Yes, continued Stash. Very helpful. So helpful, in fact, that I've decided to let you go. Thank you, sir,
said the prisoner.
No, please, sir, no!
His gratitude turned to horror as Stash, in a startling display of speed and power, dragged him swiftly to the starboard rail and hurled him overboard.
Captain!
Shouted Smee, shocked.
Yes, Mr. Smee,
said Stash, leaning over to watch as the prisoner thrashed, gasping to the surface.
But he was...
sputtered Smee.
I mean, I thought he had information that...
He gave us what we needed,
said Stash.
And now he is providing another service.
Smee looked puzzled.
Behold, said Stash. As a British seaman, he knows how to swim, at least a little.
Smee remained puzzled.
And as a British seaman in distress, continued Stash, he must not be abandoned by the gentleman in the dory. Now can he? A proper Englishman would never leave another Englishman to drown. Behold our gentleman Smee.
Stash gestured toward the dory. Smee saw that the gentleman was reaching for his oars. Stash said,
Have the harpooners make ready at the stern.
Smee relayed the order, noting as he did that the dory was now turning toward the drowning sailor. His chapped lips broke into a broad smile of pleasure, both at the cleverness of his captain and the foolishness of proper Englishmen. Leonard Astor had been studying in the trunk, wondering how he could get past its padlocks without tools or weapons, when he heard the scream from the Sea Devil and saw the man, a man in the uniform of a British seaman, hurled overboard. He saw the man struggle to the surface, thrashing desperately to stay afloat, but clearly unable to last much longer. With no hesitation, Astor seized the oars. He understood that the pirates had thrown the seaman overboard in the expectation that he would do exactly this. But trunk or no trunk, Leonard Astor was not going to sit by and watch an Englishman drown. He clung to the hope that, as he approached the Sea Devil, she would turn to him, thus exposing herself to the Wasp's cannon. But to his disappointment, the Sea Devil did not turn.
He's clever, he thought. He intends to slow my escape while he wins the Wasp. Then he'll come back for me, for the trunk.
Astor glanced back and saw he was close to the sailor, still afloat, but just barely.
I can still do it, Astor thought. With a bit of luck, I can save this man and still be far enough away that the pirates won't be able to find this tiny boat.
The thrashing sailor slipped beneath the surface. Leonard pulled harder on his oars. Scott saw now that Stash had no intention of tacking to chase the dory.
He's a clever one. He's coming for my ship first.
Scott made a decision and gave an order, instantly repeated by the first mate.
Hard to starboard!
The helmsman spun the wheel and the obedient ship quickly heeled, masts creaking, lines becoming taut. The sails went slack, shifted, then filled anew with wind. The Sea Devil was now coming up fast on his starboard side. He had a better angle on her now, better, though far from ideal. But there was no more time. In moments, the Sea Devil would be on them.
Fire!
The cannons roared, and Scott's heart sank as he saw the balls fly over the Sea Devil. The cannoneers had aimed almost level, but the heeling of the ship had pointed the barrels high. It had been a gamble, tacking and firing, and now Scott was paying. The Wasp had lost speed. The Sea Devil, undamaged, was bearing down. There was barely time for another round.
"Level her out!"
Scott roared.
"We must not miss this time."
Leonard Astor heard cannon fire, then saw a ball, then two others splash near him as he shoved an oar deep into the water at the spot where he'd seen the sailor go under. He fought to hold the oar down, moving it side to side.
"Come on, take it."
He had almost given up when he felt a tug. Straining, he slowly pulled the oar toward him, then grabbed the sailor's arm and heaved him up with an effort that almost overturned the dory, which rode dangerously low in the water now from the weight of two men and the trunk. The man coughed and spat seawater, but seemed to be all right.
"Thank you,"
he mumbled, still coughing.
"It's quite all right," said Astor.
"That madman..." began the sailor, but he was interrupted by two loud reports. Astor spun and saw twin dark lines coming from the stern of the Sea Devil and streaking directly toward the dory.
"Down!"
he shouted, yanking the sailor with him to the cramped bottom. The two harpoons, well-aimed and shot with gunpowder, hit almost simultaneously, their barbed heads thunking into the transom. 10-foot chains connected the harpoon shafts to thick rope leading back to the ship. In a moment, Astor felt a tug as the lines tightened. The dory began to move backward. The pirates were using winches to drag it to the Sea Devil.
"Black Stash is having it both ways," Astor thought with grudging admiration. "He's going after the trunk and the Wasp."
He lunged to the stern and tried to work the harpoons loose, but they were lodged too firmly in the transom. Desperately, he turned back and shouted to the sailor,
"Help me untie the trunk."
"What's that?" The man was still groggy from near drowning.
"Untie the trunk," Leonard repeated, struggling with a thick knot. "And hurry."
The sailor managed to sit up and reach for a knot on the other side of the trunk. After a moment, he shook his head.
"Wet line," he coughed. "This knot's not coming out until the line dries."
Astor yanked desperately at the rope. He looked back. The dory was almost to the Sea Devil now, the pirate's ship stern looming overhead. At last he managed to loosen the knot. He got his hands under the trunk and tried to lift it, hoping to work it free from the rope on the other side. He could barely budge it.
"Why is it so heavy?"
He tried to move it again, but could not. He looked back again and saw that he could touch the stern of the Sea Devil. Pirates were clambering down rope ladders to grab the dory. He gave one last desperate heave on the trunk, but it barely moved.
"It's no use."
Captain Scott held off as long as he dared, waiting for the Wasp to level its cannons at the onrushing Sea Devil. When he could wait no longer, he gave the order.
"Fire!"
The cannons boomed. One ball struck the pirate ship's prow, beheading the wooden mermaid. The rest flew wide. The Sea Devil came on.
"We're going to be boarded," he thought. "At least Astor may escape."
But that hope was dashed almost immediately.
"Captain Scott,"
the first mate said,
"look out reports that the pirates have the dory."
"What?"
said Scott.
"How?" "Harpoons, sir. They got it when Mr. Astor turned back to rescue a sailor from the sea, sir."
"One of ours? I did not hear of a man gone overboard."
"No, sir. It's Bingham, sir."
"Bingham?"
Scott could not believe what he was hearing.
"Yes, sir. Lookout says the pirates threw him overboard, sir."
"Bingham,"
Scott muttered. The sailor had gone missing at the last port. Scott now understood why Black Stash had followed the Wasp.
"He knew about the trunk, and now he has it."
He saw that the Sea Devil was still coming hard, pirates on the foredeck howling for blood.
"He wants the Wasp,
too. Archer!
Scott shouted.
Sir, can you cut their halyards at this range? A little closer, Captain, I think I can. Then do it. Bring down as many of their sails as you can.
Aye, sir.
Scott turned back to his first mate.
He means to board us, he said, but I mean to board him first. Tell the men to get swords and sabres and move to the stern. At my command, luff the sails. He'll catch us more quickly than he suspects, and when he does, we board him.
Scott knew he was taking another gamble.
I hope this one turns out better than the last.
Blackstache could not believe how well things were working out. He had the treasure, and he was about to take the Wasp, which might have outrun him had Captain Scott not chosen to turn and fight.
Idiot Englishman, always doing what was right.
Dory's aboard, Captain,
Smee informed him.
Excellent, said Stache, glancing back.
He saw the retaken prisoner and the idiot Englishman who'd rescued him. The trunk had been hoisted onto the deck.
20 lengths and closing fast,
came a shout from the crow's nest.
Prepare to board,
Stache shouted, his excitement building. This was the moment a pirate lived for. His men readied their swords, knives and guns. Stache estimated that the two ships would come together in about 5 minutes. Glancing around the deck, he was seized by an impulse.
Open the trunk, he shouted.
15 lengths and closing.
But sir,
said Smee.
Perhaps we should wait until after...
No! Stache roared. Open the trunk! The greatest treasure ever sent to sea.
Stache meant to see it now, in his moment of glory. Two sailors fired pistols at the locks. The chains fell away. Stache saw the idiot Englishman move forward, staring intently at the trunk lid.
What's that look in your eye, Englishman?
Stache thundered.
You think a genie is going to jump out and save you?
Something like that, the Englishman answered, and something in his voice unsettled Stache for just a moment. As he watched, the Englishman's hand reached into his shirt.
Grab his arms,
Stache shouted. A burly sailor quickly pinned Astor's arms behind his back.
10 lengths!
Captain,
said Smee.
We...
Quiet,
said Stache, striding over to the Englishman and ripping open his shirt. A bright gold locket sparkled in the sun.
What have we here?
Said Stache. He reached for the locket, and as his fingers touched it, he felt the strangest feeling, as if...
5 lengths!
Sir,
shouted Smee.
I think they're going to board us.
The Englishman pulled back, drawing the locket from Stash's grasp. Stache shook his head as if awakening from a dream. He saw that the Wasp was less than 3 boat lengths away, its aft deck swarming with armed sailors. He turned, stared for an instant into the intense green eyes of the Englishman, then leaned over to open the trunk. Time seemed to stand still as the lid slowly came up. A smile formed on Stache's lips as he readied himself to gaze upon the greatest treasure ever sent to sea.
What?
He screamed. He looked up, his face twisted with fury.
What trickery is this, Englishman?
He grabbed Astor by the coat and dragged him around the trunk lid so that he could see inside. The trunk was filled with sand. The Englishman gasped, snapped his head up and looked out to sea, suddenly remembering Arm's message, on Molly ship. Blackstache followed the man's gaze.
He's as surprised as I am,
he thought. And then Stache remembered... There had been a second ship leaving port on the day he'd been watching the Wasp. It, too, had taken many trunks aboard.
They pulled a switch, didn't they, Englishman?
Astor stared defiantly at the pirate.
It's on the other ship, isn't it?
Said Stache. Astor's jaw clenched, but he remained silent.
2 lengths!
It seems you've been had, Englishman, said Stache. And so have I. But unlike you, I can do something about it as soon as I have the Wasp.
Brace yourselves!
Came the shout from above.
We're going to ram!
Stache gestured to the burly sailor.
Take the Englishman below and lock him up, he said. I'll deal with him later.
The burly sailor reached for Astor, but just as he did, the prow of the Sea Devil struck the stern of the Wasp. The deck shuddered violently, and the sailor fell. Before he could get up, Leonard Astor had leapt overboard. Stache cursed and raced to the rail. Looking over, he saw nothing at first, and then...
Was that
The back fin of a porpoise? There was no time to look further. An arrow whizzed overhead, and the Sea Devil's main sail came cascading down on Stash and his crew. The battle had begun. It took only a few bloody minutes for Captain Scott to understand the awful truth. His second gamble had also failed. His men fought courageously, but the pirates outnumbered them 2-1. He could not stomach watching his men being slaughtered in a hopeless cause. Despair seeping into his soul, he tied his white handkerchief to the tip of his sword and gave the signal for surrender. The flag was greeted by sullen acceptance from his brave crew and howls of triumph from the pirates. Scott's last desperate hope now was that he could bargain somehow for the lives of his men. But he held no hope for himself. He was the captain, and he had lost his ship. The Wasp now belonged to Black Stash. Chapter 16. Bad News. Molly crouched on the aft deck of the Neverland, watching the water, waiting. The hours had crept by with agonizing slowness, but it was almost time. At least tonight she didn't have to worry about the men on watch. They'd found some rum somewhere, and when Molly crept by them earlier, they'd both been flat on their backs, snoring.
Heaven help this ship if we ever face any real danger.
Her thoughts were interrupted by the welcome sight of a dorsal fin breaking the surface, followed by the sound of a cheerful chitter. Molly leaned over the stern rail and, despite her anxiety, smiled broadly as a familiar silver shape appeared.
"Hello," said Arm. "My teeth are green," replied Molly.
"Yes," agreed Arm, politely. With the formalities concluded, Molly clicked and chirped the message she'd been practicing all day.
"Arm, see Molly father?"
"Yes."
"Thank goodness."
Carefully, Molly chirped,
"What news?"
Arm hesitated, then,
"Bad man have fathership."
Molly's heart froze. "Molly father," she struggled to make the sounds.
"Molly father in water."
Molly could barely breathe.
"Molly father,"
she began, but Arm mercifully cut her short.
"We swim, Molly father," he said. "Swim to Ireland."
Molly almost collapsed from relief.
"The other porpoises are taking father to land. That's why Arm came alone, but..."
"Molly father message," said Arm.
"What message?"
said Molly.
"Bad man hunt Molly ship."
Fear stabbed at Molly.
The trunk. Somehow Black Stash knows about the trunk. Father must know as well, so he...
Arm chittered again.
"Father, come, soon."
But would he be soon enough?
Molly took a deep breath, fighting to control her feelings of panic, to form the right sounds.
"Message, father," she said.
"What message?"
"Hurry."
"Hurry?"
repeated Arm.
"Yes."
And with a brief farewell chitter, Arm was gone, leaving Molly staring at the water, wondering how long it would take her father to reach land, to find a new ship, to set out, to find her.
Meanwhile, the world's most vicious pirate is hunting us down in the fastest ship afloat.
Molly had never felt so alone in her life. If Black Stash arrived before her father did, she had no choice. She would have to deal with the situation herself. She had to, and she could not fail. She needed an ally, someone she could trust. She turned from the rail to go looking for him. As she entered the ladderway, she cast one last glance back at the sea.
"Please hurry."
Chapter 17. The Next Target. The Sea Devil and the Wasp, tied side by side, rolled in the dark waves as Stash's crew, working by torchlight, finished the hard labor of moving barrels and crates from the conquering ship to the conquered one. Below decks on the Wasp, Black Stash surveyed the tidy cabin that had once belonged to Captain Scott.
"A fine cabin, Mr. Smee, is it not?" he said.
"Aye, Captain, it is," said Smee, thinking. "And it smells much better than your old one."
"Have the prisoners been dealt with?" asked Black Stash.
"Aye, sir, as you ordered. Captain Scott and the others you wanted kept for ransom and barter are locked below. The rest will be set adrift in the Sea Devil once we've moved her sails and provisions to the Wasp."
"Do you think it'll hurt me reputation, Smee, allowing them to die of thirst rather than slitting their throats?"
"No, Captain," said Smee. "I think it's a grand humanitarian gesture."
Well, tell our boys to hurry before I change my mind, said Stash. It's turning to daylight, and I want to get after that other ship. The one with me treasure. The... what's it called again?
The Neverland, sir.
Stupid name, said Stash.
Yes, Captain.
I don't much like wasp, either.
No, Captain.
A wasp is an insect.
It is, Captain.
We're pirates, Smee, not insects.
No, Captain. I mean, yes, Captain.
A pirate ship needs a name that inspires fear in the heart of every sailor who hears it, said Stash.
He drummed his bony fingers thoughtfully on the desk that once belonged to Captain Scott. Smee said,
What about the jellyfish?
Stash turned and stared at Smee with a look that Smee unfortunately mistook for encouragement.
I mean the stinging kind,
Smee continued brightly.
I've seen grown men cry when they...
Shut up, you idiot,
thundered Stash, slamming the desk with his fist. He took a long, deep breath, then continued in a calm voice.
You don't name a pirate ship the jellyfish.
I just thought...
Shut up, Smee.
Yes, Captain.
Sailors will not feel fear in their hearts at the approach of the jellyfish.
No, Captain.
I shall give this ship a pirate name, Smee.
Yes, Captain.
I shall give it the name of the most feared flag on the seven seas, the pirate flag, Smee.
That's a fine name, Captain.
What is?
The pirate flag, Captain.
Blackstash pressed his face into his hands.
Smee, he said through splayed fingers, you have seaweed for brains.
Yes, Captain.
The name of the ship will be the Jolly Roger.
But you just said...
The Jolly Roger is the pirate flag, you kelp-brained idiot.
Yes, Captain.
Now, get out of my sight and send in Seymour. We've work to do.
Seymour, who'd been waiting outside to be summoned, entered the cabin.
Yes, Captain. Have you found the ladies?
Yes, sir. Wimple went out in a boat and got them back.
Good. We raise sail as soon as we've done offloading the Sea Devil. We're after the Neverland next.
Yes, Captain.
One of the prisoners was kind enough to tell me a few things about the Neverland, said Stash, not bothering to mention that the officer had been staring at the point of Stash's cutlass, an inch from his right eyeball. He says she left port the same day the Wasp did, and she's bound for Rundoon, same as the Wasp was. She's a fat sea cow of a ship that can't make better than 5 knots, so she's well behind us. Aye, Captain. I want you to do your figuring and put us on zigzag course back in her direction, 20-mile tacks, till we spot her masts. Understand? We'll be flying His Majesty's colours. She'll sail right to us, thinking we're the Wasp, and then she's ours. Get to it.
Aye, Captain,
said Seymour, leaving. Stash drummed his fingers on the desk for another minute, wondering if he should go up and make a few prisoners walk the plank. He was tired, but it was important to keep up appearances. He was still pondering when there was a rap on his door. It was Seymour again, looking ashen-faced.
What is it?
Said Stash.
Captain, I think you need to come on deck and see for yourself, Captain.
Following the navigator to the deck, Stash saw it instantly, a dark, roiling mass of clouds spreading across the horizon, already huge and growing, growing fast. Black Stash had spent his life at sea. He had long believed that he'd faced the worst that the sea could hurl at him, and that he had nothing more to fear. But seeing this thing coming toward him now, Black Stash, for just a moment, was afraid. Chapter 18. The Plan. Peter's plan to get past the guard named Leatherface was simple but effective. It involved rum. Peter was still not sure exactly what rum was, but he knew two things about it from watching the Neverland crew. The first was that the sailors loved to drink it, and gulped it down whenever they had any. The second was that it made them sleep. Sometimes it made them do strange things first, laugh, cry, sing, fight, talk about their mothers, but in the end, it always put them into a deep slumber, from which it seemed nothing could awaken them for hours.
Peter had also learned from his many secret food forays around the ship that the cook kept a barrel of rum in the galley. This was one reason why the Neverland's food was so bad. The cook spent far more time drinking rum than cooking. He guarded his rum supply from the rest of the crew by sitting on the barrel virtually all the time, day and night. But much of the time, because of the rum, he was slumbering, which presented an opportunity for a small, clever person to creep up, quietly open the barrel's spigot, and fill a jar. And that is what Peter had done. The other part of the plan involved the foul pot of revolting food that Hungry Bob bought each morning in the crockery pot. Most days the boys left it untouched, which was fine with Hungry Bob, who collected it each night and happily downed its contents, wriggling bits and all. But not this day. This day Peter had taken the pot and dumped the rum jar into it. Both the food and the rum smelled foul to Peter. The mixture smelled no different. He'd waited until dusk, then carried the crockery pot to a secluded spot on the forward deck, where Alf was waiting as they'd arranged.
"Try to hurry," Peter said. "Hungry Bob will be coming for this soon."
"Right, little friend," said Alf, taking the pot and heading aft.
At the ladderway, he glanced around and ducked down the ladder, along a dim passageway, then down a second ladder.
"Who's that?"
came a gruff voice. It was Leatherface, a tall, raw-boned man whose skin had been ravaged by too many years in the wind and the weather. He stood in front of the door to the hold where the trunk was kept, his hand holding a club.
"It's me," said Alf. "Alf!"
"Nobody's allowed down here," barked Leatherface. "Slank's orders."
"But it was Slank who sent me," said Alf. "He sent you this here grub."
He held out the pot. Leatherface eyed it suspiciously.
"I already had me grub," he said.
I know," said Alf. "It's extra rations for the extra work you're doing."
Somewhere deep in Leatherface's brain was the beginning of a thought, that it was very much unlike Slank to make thoughtful gestures to the crew. But Leatherface was not one to encourage thoughts. And, like the rest of the underfed sailors on the Neverland, his instinct was to eat whatever there was to be eaten. He leaned the club against the hold door and took the pot from Alf.
"I'd be grateful if you'd finish it off now," said Alf. "Save me a trip back down and up these ladders. Hard on me old knees."
Leatherface grunted, raised the crockery pot, and began to swig the contents down. It tasted a bit unusual to him, but he'd had worse. At least most of the lumps was still. A half dozen gulps later, the pot was empty. Leatherface handed the pot back to Alf, picked up his club, and issued a massive belch.
"Now, get out," he said.
"My pleasure," said Alf,
as foul burp fumes filled the passageway. A few moments later, Alf was back on the foredeck, handing the pot to Peter, who peered inside.
"He ate it all," said Peter. "Like a bird eating a worm," said Alf.
"How long, do you think?" said Peter.
"If there's a jar full of rum in there," said Alf, "he'll be sleeping like a babe in an hour's time."
"Right," said Peter. "So, we'll meet here?"
"We'll meet here."
Peter hurried the crockery pot back to the boys' cabin, where in a short while it was retrieved by a disappointed Hungry Bob.
"What's this?"
he said, examining the empty pot.
"Have you lads taken a fancy to the cook's grub?"
"No,"
chorused the boys.
"Yes,"
said Peter, casting a sharp look at the others. "I mean, no, but today we were very hungry."
"You're not giving the grub to another sailor now, are you?"
said Hungry Bob.
"No, sir."
You better not be,"
said Hungry Bob.
"After all I do for you, carrying this pot down here every day."
When he was gone, James said,
"Peter, what did you do with the food?"
"Never mind what I did with it," said Peter. "You're better off not knowing."
"It's that trunk, isn't it?"
said Tubby Ted.
"It's got something to do with that stupid trunk, right?"
"I said never mind," Peter snapped.
"Creeping round the ship all the time,"
muttered Tubby Ted.
"He'll get us all in trouble, he will."
"You don't seem to mind eating the food he gets from creeping around,"
retorted James, drawing smiles from Prentice and Thomas. James turned to Peter.
"Are we going out tonight, then?"
"I am, yes," said Peter, "but I want you to stay here." James's face fell.
But I thought I was helping. I thought..."
"You have been helping," said Peter. "You're a great help, but tonight it just needs to be just me. You can help by keeping an eye on this lot, all right, mate?"
"All right,"
said James, his eyes downcast.
"That's a good man," said Peter. "I'm off, then."
In a moment he was on deck, where he found Alf waiting. Together they crept aft in the darkness, easily avoiding the two bored, gabbing sailors on watch. With Peter in front, they crept down the first ladderway and along the passageway. They stopped at the top of the lower ladderway, cocking their ears downward. There was a noise coming from below, a deep, irregular rumbling. Snoring. Peter glanced back at Alf, who nodded, and the two moved quietly down the ladderway. As their eyes adjusted to the gloom, they saw the dark form of Leatherface sprawled on his back in front of the hold door, right hand still curled around his club. Alf leaned over and took hold of the snoring man's heels, then gently pulled him clear of the doorway. Peter, heart pounding, reached for the door handle and... the door was locked. It was a padlock, passed through a hasp. Peter's heart sank. He hadn't thought of this the last time the door had been open. But of course, Slank wasn't taking any more chances. "It's locked," Peter whispered. "What?" whispered Alf. "But you said..." "I know," whispered Peter. "It wasn't locked before."
Alf bent over, and in the dim yellow light of the passageway lantern, peered at the door. He saw that the padlock and hasp, like all the iron objects on the Neverland, were old and rusted.
"Here," he whispered, "give me that club."
Peter bent down, gently pulling the club from Leatherface's fist, and handed it to the big man. Alf slid the handle end of the club down behind the hasp, then took hold of the fat end with both hands.
"Be ready to run,"
he whispered to Peter. Alf heaved back on the club. Peter heard the hold door creaking, then a pop. And then another. The hasp bolts were breaking. Another heave, two more pops. A final heave and clunk, clunkety-clunk. The hasp and padlock suddenly yanked free, bounced across the floor. For a moment neither Alf nor Peter moved a muscle. Then Peter glanced down at Leatherface. He continued to snore. Peter and Alf remained motionless for perhaps a minute, listening. They heard no steps running, no stairs creaking, nothing. Slowly they began to breathe normally again, and their attention returned to the hold door, now unlocked. Alf tugged on the handle, and the door swung open. Peter and Alf peered in, seeing nothing at first in the pitch-black hold. Wishing he'd thought to bring a candle, Peter took a tentative step forward. Still he saw nothing. He felt Alf behind him. Again he slid his foot forward.
"Stop!"
Alf and Peter froze. The hissing voice had come from behind them, on the ladderway. Heart thumping, Peter turned and...
"Molly!"
"Get away from the door,"
she whispered.
"Both of you, get out of here now!"
"Miss," said Alf, "we don't mean no..."
"You don't know what you're getting into," she said. "You must leave here this instant."
Alf, his face worried, said to Peter,
"Maybe we should..."
"No,"
said Peter, furious.
"We've come this far, and we're going to go in there, and she can't stop us."
"Yes, I can," said Molly, her voice dead calm. Peter and Alf both looked at her.
"I can scream," she said.
"You wouldn't," Peter said.
"Yes, I would."
"You don't dare," said Peter. "You're not supposed to be here either. You'd be in as much trouble as us."
"I could say I heard a noise," she said. "I heard something fall."
She pointed to the padlock.
"I came to investigate, and when I saw you, I screamed."
"All right, miss," said Alf.
"No need for that."
He put a hand on Peter's shoulder. "Come on, lad."
"No,"
said Peter, shrugging off the hand, glaring at Molly. "You go if you want. She doesn't scare me."
"I'm going to count," said Molly.
"If you're not gone when I get to 10, I will scream."
"You're bluffing," said Peter.
"1, said Molly. On the floor, Leatherface stirred, rolled over, resumed snoring.
"Little friend," whispered Alf, his tone urgent now, "I'm going."
"Go then," said Peter.
"2, please, little friend."
"No."
"3.
"All right then,"
said Alf, shaking his head.
"Good luck then."
"4.
Alf was up the ladder and gone.
5.
"Why are you doing this?"
hissed Peter.
6. "Because I have to."
Her face was grim.
"But why?"
7.
"I can't tell you."
"Tell me what? Why can't you tell me?"
8. "You wouldn't believe me anyway."
"How do you know if you don't try?"
9.
Because it's so...
Molly's voice broke. Peter saw she was crying.
"Molly, please, whatever it is, just tell me. Maybe I can help you."
For several seconds, Molly looked at him, a look of lonely desperation, tears brimming in her luminescent green eyes. Then she made a decision. Peter saw it happen, and her expression was grim again.
"She's going to say 10," thought Peter. "She's going to scream."
Molly opened her mouth.
"All right," she said. "I'll tell you."
Chapter 19. The Witch's Broom. The wind was much stronger now. Not full force yet, no, it was still a long way from the fury that every man on the Jolly Roger could see was coming. But it was strong enough to make the rigging shriek, strong enough to rip the hat from Black Stash's head and send it tumbling across the aft deck, with Smee's blubbery body scuttling after it. Stash seemed not to notice. As the gusts tossed his long, greasy curls, he stared back toward the storm. Dwindling rapidly astern was the Sea Devil, barely a speck now, manned by the sailors he'd thrown off his new ship. When the Jolly Roger had cast them off, they'd been frantically trying to jury-rig sails from whatever scraps of canvas they could find, hoping desperately to somehow outrun the black boiling clouds bearing down on them.
"Not bloody likely they'll make it," thought Stash. "It'll be dicey enough for us."
The last of the Jolly Roger's sails had just gone up, full and billowing. The masts groaned and the rigging creaked as the sleek ship, propelled by the mighty following wind, surged forward, sliding down the face of a great wave, then climbing the next. Stash grabbed a stout line to keep his balance and looked up at the rigging, a rare expression of respect on his face. He was feeling more confident now.
"She's a fine ship, this one," he roared to the helmsman. "Have you ever seen such speed?"
The helmsman could only nod. Even with his massive arms, he had to fight the wheel with all his strength to hold the course. Smee, clutching Stash's hat, staggered back across the sloping deck, casting a worried look at the storm. Most of the sky was now black. It was daytime, but the pirates below were using lanterns.
"Can we outrun it, Captain?"
Smee asked, clutching the captain's hat as if it were a baby blanket.
"Outrun that?"
Stash laughed.
"No, Smee. She's a witch of a storm, and this here,"
he waved at the wind,
"is her broom. She flies too fast for us, Smee. She'll be on us in a few hours. We'll be reefing every sail we got and dragging sea anchors before this one's through with us. But before that happens, we'll ride this witch's broom ourselves, Smee. We'll fly straight to the Neverland. She's out there, and we need to reach her before the witch herself does."
Stash looked again at the sails, then turned to the helmsman.
"I think we can coax another knot or two out of her," he shouted. "Let's put her on a broad reach, eh?"
The helmsman knew better than to question an order from Black Stash, but he shot him a glance. Putting the ship at a sharper angle to the wind would indeed increase its speed, but in this ferocious gale it would also cause the ship to heel steeply and put a massive strain on the sails, masts, and rigging. Catching the helmsman's look, Stash bellowed,
"Do it, man!"
The helmsman heaved on the wheel. The black ship slowly turned, groaning, and heeled hard to starboard. The crew grabbed for handholds as water crashed across the decks.
"Haul in them sails!" bellowed Stash. "Give me more speed!"
Despite the fearsome angle of the deck, crewmen clambered to the winches and, working furiously, managed to take in a few more feet on the sheets, which were taut as piano wires from the massive strain of holding the sails. As the ship gained even more speed, the starboard rail went under, and from below came the crashing sound of unsecured cargo tumbling in the sides of the holds.
"Smee!"
shouted Black Stash.
"Aye, Captain,"
answered Smee, who was clinging to a mast, his chubby arms wrapped around it, holding the captain's hat in front.
"Are the uniforms ready?"
"Aye, Captain."
Stash had ordered all the Wasp crewmen, including Captain Scott, stripped of their naval uniforms. They'd been left in their long johns.
"Good. Get below and have the men come down one at a time and change into the uniforms. When those idiots on the Neverland sees His Majesty's fine ship coming their way, they'll want them to see fine British seamen on deck, coming to the rescue."
"Aye, Captain,"
said Smee, grateful for the chance to get out of the weather. He released the mast and lunged for a ladderway, staggering two steps before falling belly first on Stash's hat.
"I'm all right,"
he called, crawling the rest of the way to the ladder.
"I'm all right."
Ignoring him, Stash turned to the helmsman, who was straining every muscle to keep the ship steady. Leaning close to the man's ear, Stash said,
a gold piece to you, lad, if we reach the Neverland before the full weight of this storm reaches us.
The helmsman glanced back at the rolling waves and punishing wind, then up at the straining sails, then forward into the stinging sea-salt spray.
"We'll do it, Captain," he said, "if those sails hold."
Stash grinned a wide yellow grin. The ship groaned as it rose to the top of a giant swell, then seemed to fly down the other side. The masts bowed and looked as if they might snap. At that moment, sheets of rain poured from the skies, soaking both men and beating the ocean into a furious froth. Stash, his long, wet locks streaming rainwater, tossed his head back and laughed. He hadn't had this much fun in years.
Chapter 20. Molly's Story. Peter's shoulders sagged with relief.
"Good," he said. "I knew you..."
"Not here,"
said Molly, gesturing toward the snoring Leatherface.
"We'll go to my cabin. Mrs. Bunbrake shouldn't be back for an hour, at least."
Mrs. Bunbrake had taken to spending most of her evenings in Slank's cabin, which was fine with Molly.
"All right,"
said Peter, heading toward the ladderway. "One thing first," said Molly. She picked up the padlock and hasp. "We need to find the other pieces to this."
"Why?"
said Peter.
"Just do it, please," she said.
Sighing, Peter joined Molly in searching the floor by the dim lantern light. In a minute or so, they'd found the four rusty bolts Alf had broken.
"Close the door,"
whispered Molly. Peter, having decided it was no use to question her, obeyed. Molly held the padlock and hasp up to the door and inserted the broken bolts into their former holes. Carefully, she let go. The hasp and padlock remained in place. It looked as though the door was still securely locked. Peter was impressed.
"Come on," said Molly.
Peter followed her up the ladder. She motioned him to stay in the passageway while she looked inside her cabin, seeing that it was, as she had expected, empty. She motioned Peter inside and closed the door.
"Please sit,"
she said, pointing to one of the cabin's two narrow cots.
"This will take some time."
Peter sat. Molly remained standing facing Peter, silent for a long moment, thinking. Finally she spoke.
"I shouldn't tell you any of this," she said.
"But you..."
"Just listen," she said. "I shouldn't tell you, but given the circumstances, I've decided I have no choice."
It sounded to Peter as though Molly was talking to herself more than to him.
"I'm not sure how much to tell you,"
she continued.
"There's so much I don't know myself, but if I'm to ask for your help, if I'm to ask you to risk your... I mean, there is terrible danger, and it would be wrong if you... that is, if you didn't..."
"Molly," said Peter, exasperated,
"just tell me."
"All right," she said. She took a deep breath.
"Peter, have you ever seen a shooting star?"
"Yes," said Peter. "It had been at St. Norbert's an eternity ago." The other boys were asleep. Peter was lying on the narrow wooden platform that served as his bed, staring through the slit of a window at the night sky. He'd almost not believed it the first time. The startlingly sudden, eerily silent flash of brilliant, streaking light, there for an instant, and then gone. But then he'd seen it again, and again, and again. The next day he'd asked Mr. Gremkin what the streaks were, and Mr. Gremkin had said they were shooting stars. So Peter asked what shooting stars were, and Mr. Gremkin said they were meteors. So Peter asked what meteors were, and Mr. Gremkin said they were rocks that fell from the heavens. So Peter asked if that meant that the heavens were made of rocks, and why were the rocks so bright? Were they on fire? How did rocks catch fire? And Mr. Gremkin clouted Peter on the ear and told him not to ask so many questions, and that had been the end of it.
"Do you know what they are?" said Molly.
"They're rocks," said Peter, "that fall from the heavens."
"That's true of most of them," said Molly.
"Almost all of them, in fact, but not quite all."
"What do you mean?" said Peter.
"I mean, some shooting stars are not rocks. Some, a very few, are made of something quite different. It's called star stuff. At least that's what we call it."
"Star stuff?
You mean pieces that fell from a star?"
"We don't know what it is, truthfully," said Molly, "but it's not rocks, and it comes from the heavens, and sometimes it comes to Earth, and when it does, we have to find it before the others do."
Peter shook his head. "Who do you mean by we?" he said. Who are the others? What does this have to do with... Please, Peter, she said. I'm explaining it as best I can.
Sorry, he said. Go on. All right. First, what I mean by we. Peter, I'm part of a group, a small group of people. Well, mostly people. We're called... Molly's hand went to the gold chain around her neck. The Star Catchers.
Star Catchers?
Yes. My father is one, as was his mother, and so on. Most of us are descended from Star Catchers, but not all. There have been Star Catchers on Earth for centuries, Peter. Even we don't know how long, but our task is always the same, to watch for the star stuff and to get to it and return it before it falls into the hands of the others.
Return it where?
That's difficult to explain.
Well, then, who are the others?
They're people, too, or most of them are. And they've also been around for a long time. They are our, that is, the Star Catchers' enemy. No, that's not quite right. We oppose them, but in truth, they are mankind's enemy.
Why? What do they do?
They use the power. They take it, and they...
Molly saw the puzzlement on Peter's face.
But you don't know what I mean, do you? I need to explain about the star stuff.
Is that what's in the trunk? Said Peter.
Yes, said Molly. That's what's in the trunk. It has amazing power, Peter. Wonderful power. Terrible power. It lets you do things.
What kind of things?
Well, that's one of the mysteries. It's not the same for everybody, and it's not the same for animals as for people.
The rat, said Peter. The flying rat.
Yes, said Molly. That's one of the powers it can give. Flight.
To rats, said Peter.
Not just rats, said Molly. People, too.
Peter's eyes narrowed.
It makes people fly? It can, said Molly.
Can you fly? Asked Peter.
I have, said Molly.
Prove it, said Peter.
What?
Prove you can fly.
Peter, this isn't the time or the...
Peter was on his feet now. Listen, he said, you're asking me to believe, I mean, it all sounds like nonsense, really, this star stuff and these others, and I don't know why I should believe any of it.
Peter, you saw the rat.
I don't know what I saw. I mean, I saw a rat in the air, yes, but what if it was a trick? What if, I don't know, what if you tied a string to it?
There was no string, Peter. The rat got into the star stuff somehow. It was flying.
Prove it.
Peter, please, you must prove it.
Molly took a deep breath, exhaling slowly.
All right, then, she said. I really shouldn't do this, but if you're going to be stubborn...
I am, said Peter.
Then sit down.
Peter sat. Molly reached her hand to her neck, put her finger under the gold chain, and from under her blouse pulled out a small golden five-pointed star. She placed this on the palm of her left hand, which she held at neck level.
What's that? Said Peter. A locket, said Molly.
With her right hand, she opened the lid of the locket. As she did, it was suffused by light, so that Peter couldn't see the locket, only a small, glowing sphere of golden light. Molly's face and the cabin ceiling above her were bathed in a glow. Peter had the strangest sense that he could feel the light, as well as see it.
Is that...
he began.
Quiet,
said Molly. Slowly, carefully, she touched her right index finger into the sphere.
Oh,
she moaned, leaned her head back, her eyes closed, her expression calm, blissful. She remained that way for perhaps 5 seconds, and then there was the click of the locket closing, and the glow was gone. Peter wanted it back. Molly's head came forward, and she opened her eyes, which to Peter looked unfocused and more luminescent than ever.
Are you all right? Peter said.
Molly blinked, then looked at Peter.
Yes, she said. I'm all right.
What was...
Shh,
Molly said.
Watch.
She stared at Peter, and he stared back into her startling green eyes. After a few moments, Peter said, I don't see anything.
Peter, she said, look at my feet.
He looked down and gasped. Then he jumped up from the cot and dropped to his hands and knees, his cheek pressed to the floor, looking to see how she did it, what the trick was. But there was no trick. Her feet weren't touching the floor. They were at least 2 inches above it, and as Peter looked, the distance grew. Molly was rising, her head now gently touching the cabin ceiling. As it did, her body began to pivot until she was completely horizontal, facing the floor, her back pressed to the ceiling, as though she was sleeping up there. She smiled down at Peter.
"Now do you believe me?" she asked.
"Yes," said Peter.
"Good," she said.
Her legs swung back down to the vertical, and she descended gently.